205 DGS on KMOX. Let's talk some sports. Andrew, you said that the internet's calling for my best friend Ollie Marmol's head on a pike.
Yeah, they are. They're not loving him, which, you know, got to feel pretty good. But no, it's. And I know Kevin doesn't agree with that, but boy, I think he is in the minority amongst Cardinals watchers at the moment. And also, but you know what? I agree with Kevin after spending the weekend, you know, on social media, on Twitter and stuff. Getting tired of whiny Cardinals fans on Twitter, man.
Tell me about it.
Everything.
I'm not online, so I don't ever see them.
It's just every inning is like, oh, you thought we weren't at rock bottom yet? Well, now we're at rock bottom. This is rock bottom. And meanwhile, like,
Kevin, is that sports fans? Is that baseball fans? Is that Cardinals
the
fans?
The most intense people tend to live and die with every single thing that happens.
Yeah.
Right? They don't all go super negative right away. But a lot of people, as in sports we say, a lot of people wear it. You know, when things are going great, they're all about it. They're having a fun day every day. When things are going bad, they're not having a fun day, and they tend to vent. But again, when we say Cardinals Twitter, that's more accurate than saying Cardinals fans, because their Cardinal fans are, I would say, largely just calm, you know, normal. Like, they're going to go to the ballpark. They enjoy baseball. They want the team to be better, and they're unhappy, but they're not all living and dying with every pitch.
Yeah.
But there's a percentage, and I'd probably put it at 25-30%. Those are your diehards.
Good percentage.
By the way, you need them.
Yeah.
Those are the people that are, like, they watch every game. You know, you notice when they're on Twitter and they're critiquing things, it's because they're watching every game. So those are important fans to not necessarily, you're not going to, you know, make moves based on, you know, people that are angry online. But those are people that you need to keep. I mean, those are people that are diehards that are fueling ratings every day and going to games.
But although, how often, and I always wonder this, because you see it with, like, you know, you see it with TV shows, radio shows, sports teams, all this. In a sports team, in your opinion, those diehards, right, the people who are lifelong Cardinals fans and they're like, this is it, I'm out on this team. How many of those people actually get out on the team? Right?
Almost none.
Yeah.
I'm not saying none. There are some. It's almost none. Just like we did with the whole Colin Kaepernick thing in the NFL. I'm done with the NFL. Really? Because the ratings keep going up.
So people are done with us all the time. Then comment the next day.
Yeah, so does the team really concern itself?
No,
with
they
the
don't.
Diehards
the teams don't read. Well, yeah, they do, but with their behaviors, not with their tweets. Hmm. Right. So if fewer tickets start being sold, oh, they're going to listen. If the ratings go down on Valley Sports Midwest or on the radio, they're going to pay attention to those things. They're not going to listen to angry tweets, but they're going to pay attention to what their customers do.
Same problems. Different series, same problems.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Sonny Gray was awesome yesterday, man. He struck out 12 guys and 6 1/3.
I never get emotional, and I wasn't, like, crying, but it pissed me off that we didn't support him.
Well, they're not doing a lot of supporting of anything right now. I mean, if you look at all of the, you know, the offensive numbers, you're at the bottom of the National League. You're either worst or second worst in almost everything. You have the fewest home runs in the National League, second fewest, I think, in all of Major League Baseball. Behind the White Sox, who are terrible and have a bunch of injuries. And they've been, I think I saw this, it's 8 games now without a home run. Like, that can't happen in 2024. You're not going to win that way. You have to, I'm not saying that it's all home runs, but if you're not hitting home runs, it's very hard to score. Because the way that Major League Baseball is now, with so many teams having guys that strike people out, stringing 3, 4, 5 hits together for a 3-run rally is really hard.
Okay, let's get in the weeds a little bit about the coaching thing.
Yeah.
Because I understand why normies say they sucked last year, they suck this year, what's the common denominator? It's the coach. And you say, well, the coach doesn't play, the coach never takes an at-bat, the coach is not responsible for the X's and O's in the ways you guys think they are. I get that. In what ways can an organization, if any, screw up a player? Like a bad hitting coach, a bad pitching coach. Like, I used to be able to hit until your boy got a hold of me. Or is that even a thing?
Well, I mean, it can be, but like the fundamental misunderstanding that people have is they seem to think that when you get to a team, let's say the Cardinals, that the hitting coach pulls you aside and says,
like, it's Corey League.
Right. The hitting coach is not taking these players and saying, come over here, we're going to teach you how you're going to do things in a different way. They're not doing that. You're going to go do what you do, and if you need help, you seek it out. Or if there's a problem, like, you know, using Paul Goldschmidt as the example, he's hitting .179 for no power. That would be, and Goldschmidt and the hitting coach Turner Ward are friends. They've worked together forever. They worked together in Arizona, and obviously they've worked together here. So if what they did together has worked for 12 or 13 or 14 years, doesn't it stand to reason that's probably not why the player is struggling?
Yes, it does.
Right? That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like, and he's not taking a hitting coach or an assistant hitting coach are not taking a player like Jordan Walker and saying, okay, Jordan, everything you've ever done before, throw it out the window. We're doing it differently. And a player has to also be willing and able to accept change. Like if they're struggling, okay, here's what we think you can do better. Does the player want to do it? Can they do it on the fly? Some people have to do it in an offseason. Sometimes it's hard to do on the fly in the middle of a season. So whether it's a veteran player or a kid, it all varies. But then what we do as outside observers is oversimplify. We oversimplify what that job and that relationship is. Now, you will get times where players have tuned a coach out. So a hitting coach, for example. And that's the time you probably need to make a change. But we don't know that on the outside. We can't know it unless somebody on the inside tells us that. So the problem is, if there is communication issue, if there is something that's not working and people aren't listening we won't know it until after the fact.
Remind me, did Goldschmidt have a good spring?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think I think that was one of the storylines where his spring was not particularly good. And it was a concern. I'll double check it while we're talking, but and you know, when you're talking about a player like that, there's nothing that he needs to learn. There's nothing that, you know, his swing works. We know his swing works as long as he's doing things the way that he's always done them.
Yeah.
What we don't know is it slowing down because he's 36 years old?
You made a statement today that if it is decline.
Yeah, he had a horrible spring.
Because he's a very young man. He's just not young baseball player.
Right.
But you said something to the effect of, if it is decline, this is what decline looks like.
It is. I mean, what happens in decline? I mean, pitches you used to hit, you don't hit anymore. You know, pitches you used to hit hard, you don't hit anymore. The high end of how hard you hit the ball starts to come down. When you looked at Paul Goldschmidt last year, all of those things basically worked in his favor. You know, he had his statistics were down a little bit, but he still hit the ball hard. He still hit the ball hard as often as he had in the past. And as much as people hate to hear it, a lot of what went wrong for him last year was bad luck, right? When you're hitting the ball hard and hitting the ball hard a lot and you're not getting hits, it's bad luck. That's not the case right now. If you're looking at like how hard he hits the ball on average, well, it's down almost 5 miles an hour from last year. To understand that, that is a huge difference. Right, the difference between an average hitter and an elite hitter is about 3 miles an hour. So on average, again, on the average exit velocity, his high-end exit velocity is down almost 5 miles an hour. And then the frequency with which he's making that contact is down. So yeah, it's a legit worry because he hit .125 in the spring and he's hitting .179 now. So it's not, for him, it's not just 3 weeks of struggling in the major leagues.
How much longer can it go?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it has to go a lot longer than this. You're paying him $26 million. You know, he's a proven player. You got to give him time to show that this is a slump and not the beginning of the end. So, you're not going to do anything permanent or big until you're much later in the season, May, June.
All-star break.
But you are getting to the point soon. Not now, but early May. Where you're like, if this is still going on, you got to start sitting him more. You're going to have to pull him out of the lineup more. You're going to have to hit him seventh in the lineup instead of second or fifth. It'll have to start happening at some point. We're not quite there yet, although they did move him down yesterday. I think they dropped him down to fifth. That's a good thing. Get him out of the top, move him down, move other players that are hitting better up, because the higher you hit in the lineup, the more you hit.
It's such a, I feel silly even saying this, to say how horrible it must be for him.
Oh, yeah.
Someone making $26 million who's super handsome and has had a great career and probably a Hall of Famer. But it would be, because all those things are true, and yet he seems like the kind of guy that he probably lays awake.
He absolutely cares, you know. And look, Arenado's the same way. Those guys care a lot. They're not the guy that's just like, well, I made my money and had a great career, whatever. Those guys are wearing it. They care. And it probably contributes to the struggling that you care as much as you do, because you probably overdo it. You're not sleeping well enough. You're probably doing too much in the cage early in the day because you're trying to get right. But sometimes that can be counterproductive when you're 36. So, yeah, it sucks because you know he cares and he's trying.
And all of us who played, even like Cory League High School, know that nothing fixes a slump like getting out of a slump. You know what
Boy,
I mean?
It's
like
so
if he
hard,
were
though.
To hit 400 in May, we're fine.
Right. Well, that's the thing is what we don't know. So like use Wilson Contreras as an example. He came to the Cardinals last year. The first month was terrible. He didn't hit. They ended up benching him for a short time, creating all that thing. Well, when you looked up at the end of the year, his numbers were what they should be. In fact, they were actually on the higher end of what his career numbers would say that they should be. So, yeah, there's a long time. There's a guy, my buddies all are in Detroit, so they follow the Tigers closely. There's a guy there, their first baseman, Spencer Torkelson. In April of last year, couldn't have been worse. He was horrible. He ended up with 30 home runs in the season. Like, you have to allow for that possibility.
Yeah.
While also, it's fair to say you can be worried now.
Yeah.
Because when you're stringing together what you saw in the spring, which was bad.
How about as a team?
As a team?
Far as like where we are in the standings, how long until you start going, this is feeling...
Well, you are now in the standings where you were this time last year. That's your worry, right? Because last year didn't go well. You still have to let it play a little bit longer because, again, if you look at the standings right now around Major League Baseball, if you just look at who everybody thought was going to be good, who everybody thought was going to be bad, there are outliers on both ends of the spectrum, right? The Dodgers are supposed to be this powerhouse. They're two games over 500.
Even if you're right about the coaching, if we are where we are now, three-fourths of the way through the... What would it take for Marmol to not make it through the season?
I mean, I after giving in the extension, I wouldn't think that they're going to make that change this year. They can. It's not that they can't.
Do you still believe in that move? It was a good move?
I don't think it's good or bad. I think I'm a neutral on it. I don't have a strong feeling positive and a strong feeling negative because they don't have enough evidence. How do I know if what's gone wrong in the last calendar year is because of him or because the players have gotten worse? Because they didn't do a good job with the pitching staff last year. Mo admitted that. He's been out there publicly saying what we chose to do last year with pitching did not work. That's our fault. So do I put that on the manager? I put last year as kind of an incomplete. And by the way, I don't give him credit for the first year when they made the playoffs because that's also the players. You know, that's also the structure of the roster. So I'm still deciding what I think the manager is going to be because you can't decide that in a year or two. If you had decided that a year or two into Tony La Russa's career, people would have written Tony La Russa off. Because he did. He got fired by the White Sox on his first job. And then what followed? One of the greatest managerial careers ever. I'm not predicting that for Ollie or anyone. That's ridiculous. You don't predict Hall of Fame. But what I'm saying is if you had judged TLR at the same stage of his career, the judgment would have been this guy's not going to make it.
Fair enough. So, Rach, physical media is dead.
Well, it's dying at Target. They have plans to pretty much completely eliminate it from their stores by 2025. And by physical media, I mean things like Blu-rays, DVDs, CDs. Target was kind of one of the last places you could go to pick up stuff like that. So looks like we are making the switch to digital,
whether we like it or not. I remember the day I saw CDs. It was like at Best Buy. And I was just looking at him, and the young guy working there goes like, it's $12 a week habit, dude. And I'm like, what are they? And he pulled one out, and I was like a bird watching it as he like moved it in the light. And he's like, it's music, dude. It's an album. I'm just like, shut up.
It's shiny.
And now that's so old school.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie, though. Having hard copies is pretty great when your internet goes down for a day.
Oh, yeah.
Mike, what else are you going to do?
And I feel like I have to point this out every time. Now, I'm a digital guy. I have books on my phone. I only have, like, for video games, I don't have any disc versions for any of my systems, really. They're all digital. But I should point out that's not necessarily better because what you are owning when you own something digitally is you're owning a license to view that thing.
Right.
And those licenses can and have been, on many occasions, completely revoked. And they have the right to do that. So when you pay $40 for a movie online or whatever, you're buying the right to watch that. You're not buying that movie. Whereas if you buy the Blu-ray of it, you have that film on a disc, and
right.
No one can take that from you. Sort of walking into your house and yanking it out of your hands. Whereas digitally, they can just sort of flip a switch, and you can no longer have access to that, even though you pay good money for it.
I'm right about this. That for vinyl to match digital, you have to have a really nice system. But to me, if you have a really nice system, there's just nothing that will ever replace vinyl. Just as far as albums, album covers, double albums, reading the lyrics.
But the visual of it, for
sure. The visual,
yeah.
The physical, yeah.
The ritual
tactile.
Of taking it
the
out.
Ritual, yeah. Holding it on the outside, just, I don't know.
Yeah, the problem I always have with those, then you have the thing like, well, it gets scratches, and then sometimes the needle gets dusty, and like there's so many things that can go wrong versus a digital copy, which is going to sound exactly like it did in the studio, and it doesn't degrade, it doesn't change. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean, though, that there isn't something about the experience
and things going
of what you're
is,
talking about.
You know, it's part of the fun.
Mm-hmm.
Needle gets dusty, clean the needle.
I don't want
you know
perfection.
What I mean? And I think that is probably vinyl is at this point the most popular form of physical music. Vinyl
See, Kevin just
are,
said something really interesting. He likes perfection. I don't.
Yeah, right. Right.
And like I like in the Beatles and the Stones when they messed up and they kept it.
Oh no, I like that. I don't want it to degrade on my end.
Mm.
I don't want my like the old cassette tapes where they start to play a little weird or they skip forward. Or if I get a scratch on my vinyl, now it's scratched, and I got to go get
that
a new
I
one.
Kind of like,
do you?
Yeah, it's part
yeah,
of the fun.
But yeah, I don't like.
I
that.
Would rather have an old guitar or an old drum set where someone has put a beer bottle on their amp for 40 years. I dig that.
I remember having vinyl rips on my phone back before like Spotify and stuff. Back when you just had iTunes and you could download stuff off the internet, and I would download like vinyl rips of songs, and they would have like a little glitch or a skip in them. And now when I hear the song the right way,
without it,
it's like weird. It's weird to hear it without the weird little glitch or skip or whatever.
Yeah.
I just listened to it a million times when I was in high school with the little glitch or skip.
You realize in your life you're just going to have a chip in your brain.
Yeah.
And it's going to have everything that you've ever wanted, and you're just going to blink your eyes and it's going to happen.
I'm down with that.
Look, all I know is they're charging $30 for Dune 2, and you don't even get a little...
I saw that.
Yeah, because I wanted to watch it, and then you click on it, it's like $30.
On Amazon, it's $24.95 just to rent.
Just to rent, yeah.
How stupid do you think I am? I already did that last week twice. 235 DG asking to talk to our good friend Avi Loeb, who's the head of astronomy at Harvard. He has been looking into these interstellar objects and the one that landed in the ocean near Papua New Guinea. And he is talking about how maybe they're not interstellar objects in that they folded space or they came through a wormhole. Maybe they're interdimensional. So we're going to talk to Avi about what that means and how the scientists at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, are trying to unlock these secrets. Avi, my friend, good to talk to you. How have you been?
I've been great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, always good. Always exciting. So talk us through to us mere mortals. I think I have the basic understanding of dimensions, the very basic, but try to expand on that, what you mean when you say interdimensional.
Well, we have three spatial dimensions that we are aware of and the time. So that makes four dimensions in Einstein's theory of space and time, but it's quite possible that there are additional dimensions that we are not have not yet found evidence for. And in fact, over the past 50 years, string theory at the frontier of theoretical physics did speak about dimensions that go up to 10 or 11 of them. Mm-hmm. It's possible that the reality that we see is only a small fraction of the entire set of dimensions that are out there. The question is whether if a technological civilization beyond Earth, for example, takes advantage of those dimensions, can they actually use them to traverse large distances or do something else with them?
Avi, I know that physically, with our human senses, we only see something like 0.003 of what's actually happening around us. Is it similar with our technology? Is our technology such that we are missing a great deal of what's going on out there?
Yeah, I mean, we surveyed a small fraction of the observable universe so far, and there is a lot for us to explore. And I would say that, you know, we are very limited in what we can actually learn from the vantage point of the Earth. And once we leave the solar system, you know, with maybe AI, artificial intelligence astronauts that would inform us what is outside, we might realize that there is a lot going on that we were not aware of. For example, even when we do the mass budget of the universe, we don't know what 84% of the matter is. We call it the dark matter, and we don't know what the nature of this substance is, and that's the majority of matter in the universe. There is also the vacuum energy, which is called the dark energy, that we don't know much about. So, you know, at the moment, we have some limited knowledge, but it's an island in an ocean of ignorance, and we're just at the beginning of figuring out what's out there. Let me just give you another context here. The mass of our body, the weight of our body, is the geometric mean. It's geometric mean is the square root of the product of two things. And so it's the geometric mean of the mass of the proton and the mass of the sun. We are sort of in the middle of this scale, logarithmic scale. And the mass of the Milky Way galaxy, our own galaxy, is at the geometric mean between the mass of the sun and the mass of the universe that we can see. And so it's really interesting, because suppose the same applied to intelligence, you know, that we were at the geometric mean between the intelligence of a single cell life form, you know, a life form that is the most primitive we know about, and the most advanced intelligence that is beyond what we have. If we were sort of in the geometric mean between the two, just imagine how many things we are unable to comprehend.
Well, that's really fascinating. I hadn't planned on bringing this up, but you kind of set the table for me. I recently read an article by an astrophysicist. I'm sure you've heard of it, if not read it. But going against the grain of the Big Bang and saying that based on the redshift and the Doppler effect, that this individual astrophysicist is not so sure that there was a Big Bang, or that the Doppler effect or the redshift proves it. It could be something else, and that maybe the universe has just always been and always will be. Going against, of course, the mainstream, which is that there was a Big Bang 13.8 years ago. How does it hit you?
Yeah, 13.8 billion years ago.
Yes, 13.8 years ago, I had hair.
Yeah. So the problem, I mean, there were claims of this nature over the past 60 years, you know, since the first evidence for the Big Bang came about. The thing is, by now we have a lot of data on the universe, and that includes, you know, the relic radiation from the early hot phase of the universe. It's called the cosmic microwave background. That was actually the first piece of evidence that indicated there was a hot phase, there was a hot Big Bang. But since then, you know, we mapped the distribution of galaxies, we understand how structure forms in the universe. And all of these pieces hang together to a level of, I would say, 5% or so. They hang together very well, and there is no discrepancy. And what people often refer to in terms of what the Webb telescope found is that it simply found galaxies that are much brighter than we expected, but that you can account for by having a population of stars that are much brighter than the ones that we see in our vicinity. And it's sort of natural, because the early stars were expected to be more massive and brighter. So there is really no major discrepancy. There are some tensions within the standard model of the universe, where, you know, the expansion rate that we measure locally is within 10% of the expansion rate that we would infer based on data from the early universe, from the infant universe. But those differences could be just as a result of the measuring uncertainties in the measurement. And at the moment, you know, we have a very consistent picture about the Big Bang. I wouldn't claim there is any reason to suspect that it might be wrong. And the question, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is what happened before the Big Bang? That's really the question that I would ask extraterrestrials if we ever met with them. Because at the moment, we have no way of figuring it out because Einstein's theory breaks down at the Big Bang singularity, and we just don't know what happened before then.
Avi, I'm fascinated by this, the study of what we just can't understand. So you're talking about the extra dimensions that we can't measure, but math say, or the math says it could easily be there. We think it's there. It shows that it's there. Is there the idea that there could be a master key that could unlock this ability for us to understand or measure those things? Or is it just going to have to be like the long, old process of taking everything step by step so you can get to a certain point?
Yeah, I think, you know, in science, in trying to learn about the reality that we all share, we really need to be guided by evidence, by data from experiments. Now, in the past, we were trying to do the experiments ourselves. You know, we had laboratories that gave us new insights about the fundamental laws of physics. I'm trying to get us a shortcut. You know, it's just like being in a class where you have a student that is much smarter than everyone else. And if you were to speak with that student, you would figure out things that otherwise the teacher did not really tell you. And, you know, we might have that experience when we encounter another civilization that is far more advanced than we are, simply because they had more than one century of science and technology. So if you imagine the way we would be in 1,000 years from now, you know, it's really far more advanced than we are right now, because we have some technologies like artificial intelligence that are evolving exponentially. And it's just difficult to imagine how the future would look like. Just, you know, if you think about it, go back in time a few thousand years, there is the biblical story about Moses that witnessed a burning bush, and the burning bush was not consumed, and that convinced Moses that there is a superhuman entity called God, and he believed in God as a result. And nowadays, you can easily buy online something that would look like a burning bush that doesn't get consumed. It's just a, you know, a consequence of our technologies right now. That, and it would have impressed Moses as much. So my point is, if we meet a much more advanced civilization, you know, we could get a shortcut. We might learn about things that we haven't figured out yet that represent our future. And that would be a good thing to do. I mean, I'm really eager to know much more. And if we would do it ourselves in our laboratories, it may take a while.
We're talking to Avi Loeb, who's the head of astronomy at Harvard. So, Avi, the last we spoke, and just for everyone who may not be familiar with Avi's work, he found these amazing, some sort of metallic sphericals down under the ocean off of Papua New Guinea, where this interstellar mass had hit. What's the latest out of Papua New Guinea?
Right. So we went there in June 2023, just about 9 months ago, and we found 850 molten droplets. And out of those, about 10% had a chemical composition, material composition, that does not resemble materials from the solar system. Doesn't look like the crust of the Earth, doesn't look like the Moon or Mars or asteroids. And this is independent evidence that there might have been an object that crashed there that came from outside the solar system. It's independent of the data that came from the U.S. Space Command that used the U.S. government satellites to detect the fireball and measure the speed of the object. And the object was moving too fast to be bound to the sun. And now we have an independent confirmation of that. But we want to go there again and find the bigger pieces of the object, because these droplets that we found were less than a millimeter in size, the size of a grain of sand. And the next expedition will be costly. I mean, it will be about $7 million for us to use the equipment that we need to find the bigger pieces. And that includes a remotely operated vehicle and a video feed and so forth. And so we're now just starting to seek funding from potential donors. And if anyone is listening that could potentially provide us with a $7 million, you know, that would secure a seat in our ship, which we already have. We have a ship that we reserved, and it's just a question of the funding at the moment.
I think that's great. Avi, where do people look to find all of your work and more about what you're doing?
I write almost every day or 2 days on medium.com. So if you just Google Avi Loeb, L-O-E-B, at medium.com, you will get updates. And otherwise, you can find my contact information online, my email address, and also my books. The latest one was Interstellar. Previous one was Extraterrestrial. And I'm now working on a new book. And there will also be a Netflix documentary about my research, hopefully coming out in 2025.
Excellent. Always good to talk to you, Avi. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up at the top of the hour, we have Chet Pleban, who's going to tell us how the first day of the actual trial for Donald Trump went, and talk about the Supreme Court. Really interesting case about homelessness. They're basically, there's a small town, I forget where, Ohio, Pennsylvania, something like that, this idyllic little 40,000 person town that has been taken over by homeless people, and they are trying to run them out. And they have sued and said that this is protected by many different things, including First Amendment speech, sort of the way that in Missouri we said that panhandling was First Amendment speech and you couldn't fine people or put them in jail for it. So in the next coming months, we're going to find out whether homelessness is a crime or not. How's it hit you guys?
Man.
Should you be able to fine people for being homeless?
I mean, my inclination is definitely no. I don't think, to me, that just contributes to a cycle of, oh, I can't afford a home, but you're going to fine me.
Right.
That makes no sense.
How much of not in my backyard do you have? Like if they did it on your street.
Yeah. Opened a shelter.
No, like people just started pitching.
Decided living in your neighborhood.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Which is what they're doing.
I mean, nobody wants that in their neighborhood, but I don't know.
But for example, Kurt's doing a pop-up in a park tonight, right?
Right.
And what if there were 100 tents and people don't feel comfortable?
That would be tough.
I find it very difficult because I am the same way. Like, well, of course, homelessness is not illegal. It's something that is thrust upon you. But if it's in my neighborhood, suddenly I want you gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean,
I can admit that.
And like thinking about where I live in the suburbs, like in a neighborhood, there's very little space in there that is public. You'd have to literally be on the street, right? You couldn't be on my lawn. My lawn is my property. I can ask you to leave. But when we're talking public spaces, that's the question, right? So,
and that's what they're doing is they're setting up in every common grass area.
Right, right. Yeah. And then the question becomes, I think anyway, whether or not their presence and their choosing to be there, I don't know what you call it permanently, but regularly, inhibits other people from using public spaces. I think finding people who clearly don't have money, it seems like a terrible idea.
Yeah, I mean, there seems like there's a way to address it that maybe gets around to making them pay you money. But I mean, I'm more resources, more shelters, more programs that put people in touch, you know, more places like St. Patrick Center that'll help you get into an apartment and help you find a job.
Mm-hmm. So use Keener Plaza as an example. If people, if 200 homeless decided to set up tents and everything there, it's public land. It's not privately owned. It's not the Cardinals property. It's not the Blues property. It's publicly owned. But that prevents anyone else who lives in the area from being able to go there because the space is taken up.
Yeah.
Is that a different issue than if they set up where they did now, which is over there kind of by the Museal Bridge, right there down Tucker, where there's kind of an empty place that's not being used and isn't really disrupting anybody else?
Yeah.
Is there a difference between those two things?